Are we good to go? Right. So yesterday we looked at integration, and so we've now got to the point where we know how to include other matter fields in with gravity and even start to fiddle around with the gravitational physics itself. So I want to now take a closer look at some of the things that I introduced already when I was discussing the accelerating black hole solution. So if we're going to, particularly if we're going to step up to higher dimensions, and think about black hole solutions that are not necessarily sort of round or isolated, we want to think a little bit about extended objects. So what I want to discuss today is ways of looking at things that, from a technical point of view, we're going to call submanifolds. So when we derived the Einstein action yesterday, gosh, when there's lectures every day, it suddenly all seems to, you poor souls must find this even worse. When I was discussing this variational principle, I mentioned that I'd sort of been a little bit cheeky about varying the Einstein-Hilbert action, and that the boundary term wasn't just having delta GAB on the boundary. I had to say something about the derivatives of delta GAB. So, from yesterday, so when we varied the Einstein-Hilbert action, we got something that gave us the Einstein tensor, which was the bit we wanted, and then we got a total derivative. So we also had something that looked like that. It was a total derivative, but when you integrate by parts to get rid of it, your boundary term is not something involving just delta G. So notice here we've got D4 for our space, and we've gone to D3, and this is the boundary of the manifold. So if we want to be strictly correct, the usual thing for variational principles is you vary with respect to your field or your Q, whatever, and you say that you want the action to be stationary. So in other words, the variation of the action is zero, provided the variation of your physical object on the boundary is zero. So that's the action principle. Here, though, we're having to cheat. We're saying it isn't delta G that's zero, it's derivatives of delta G. And that should actually make us a bit uneasy, okay? So, I mean, initially, of course, when you first discover an action, you're probably just going to, that's one of those things that you say, okay, I'll leave that for later, and I'll deal with that later, because you've got the Einstein tensor, which is what you wanted. But it's that, you know, I want to deal with that later now. So can we add in, can we do something to this Einstein-Hilbert action which will take care of this term and mean that we are only ever requiring that delta G equals zero on the boundary? So this is a question. So can we do that? That's the question that we're moving towards. So if we're sort of looking, we've got our manifold here. This would be schematically. Here's our manifold. This is our boundary. And since we want to cancel something that's happening on the boundary, we would have to do a boundary term. So we need a boundary term, and if we need a boundary term, then it means, you know, if you put back a physicist's hat on again, it means that we're imagining this boundary has some sort of physical meaning. It's got some reality or legitimacy to it. Saying that in inverted commas, but what it really means is we're going to actually have to sort of look at the boundary itself and look at its degrees of freedom. In other words, we're going to have to think about it as being manifold. So that's one situation in which we encounter the need to look at submanifolds. It's a submanifold because it's a subset of the original manifold. Well, in this case, it's a boundary. But there's other situations in which you can encounter submanifolds, and those I was talking about 2 days ago when I was talking about black holes. So if we have an extended physical source, remember I was talking about these cosmic strings, then those two are submanifolds. I didn't discuss domain walls, but it doesn't exactly take a great deal of imagination to figure out that what I mean by a domain wall is literally an object which is like some plane or planar type of object in space-time. So it's like an infinitely extended sheet of paper. So these objects, typically, although we introduced the cosmic string as a linear energy density, I also mentioned you could smooth it out by looking at actual fields. Same with domain walls. But these objects you expect to have degrees of freedom. So in other words, they could fluctuate. In the case of the wall, it would be one fluctuation normal to the wall. Here you might have a sort of delta x, delta y. You've got 2 degrees of freedom. So these objects, they lie within your manifold, so they look like some subset of the manifold. They have some sort of degrees of freedom for moving around within the manifold, and you'd like to have a way of describing that in within a sort of formalism rather similar to what we introduced for the whole concept of manifolds. So this leads us to something called Gauss-Kadatze. And so I want to talk a bit about this way of describing submanifolds.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if the cosmic string is like a boundary of a manifold.
In this case, it isn't, because it's got here, we've got two ways in which it can fluctuate. Okay. So I'm motivating why looking at submanifolds and having a way of dealing with them and formalizing what they are is useful. So yesterday we'd done integration, and at the moment it probably seems a bit of a nitpicky thing, but I'm saying if we want to do the variational principle properly, then we would have to have a boundary term so that we only ever require delta G to vanish. Now, I mean, so you know, you either are or are not bothered by the necessity to do that from the point of view of equations of motion. But if you get into a situation where you need to calculate a gravitational action, and we will be getting into those situations, then you do need to make sure that your action is complete. And so by adding a boundary term to make the variational principle work, that actually does the job of giving you a complete action. So it's saying that the dynamics of the space-time in general are not just the sort of dynamics of the interior manifold, but they can also include dynamics of a boundary. So obviously if your boundary is at infinity, like the sort of asymptopia of flat space-time or a Schwarzschild black hole, from the point of view of just dynamics, normal physics, you wouldn't sort of imagine that there was a boundary to worry about. And it only comes in if you're doing something, you know, like computing actions. But if you have like a wall where you want to have parts of space which are then bounded by some wall here, then you do need to think about how to describe that boundary consistently, because it's something that you can kind of walk up to and see. So you need to know that you've done it properly. So that's the sort of thing I'm trying to say. It's in terms in which you're dealing with a boundary, you're really dealing with something which is a wall. But you can extend this whole formalism. When the mathematicians developed it, they weren't thinking about boundaries. They're just looking generally at submanifolds. So I want to just, although in practice, I'm only really going to end up giving examples and applying it to walls and boundaries, I wanted to introduce it in a slightly more general way so you can see how it sort of fits in for more general submanifolds.
And we can give like physical properties to these.
In certain cases.
I was confused about like cosmic strings have mass.
Yes.
We like thought of the cosmic strings as topological defects of our space-time.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean for the defect to have mass?
Well, in the same way as a piece of string might have a mass per unit length. So it means, it means that in terms of the stuff making it up.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused about the stuff making it up.
Oh, well, that takes a bit of time to get that one. So, I don't think this is the appropriate time to try and go down that rather thorny avenue. Okay, so what Gauss-Kadatze does is to describe embeddings of submanifolds. In space-time. (Clears throat) let's think about a submanifold. Call it sigma, capital sigma. Okay, so I'm going to, you know, do this generally. So sigma imagine that I have this sigma, which is a subset of my manifold. Sigma will have dimension d in general. My manifold is going to have dimension capital N. And so that means that sigma has codimension little n, which is n minus d. So sigma itself is going to be a manifold. So if I didn't know about n, I would think that I just had a normal little d dimensional manifold. So what that means is I can pick little n vectors. If I pick a point on sigma, then I can pick a vector which is completely normal to sigma. And I'm sorry for the overuse of the letter n here. So I'm going to take my vectors to be mutually orthogonal, just for convenience, really. So what does it mean, normal to N? Means is sigma itself is a manifold in its own right, d-dimensional, so it's going to have a set of coordinates on it, and that means that if I choose one of those coordinates, then the vector acting on that function gives me zero. So it's a bit like saying that the coordinates themselves, another way of thinking of it, is that the coordinates define some vector which is lying tangent to the manifold, d by d sigma, and that vector is normal to one of these ends. Of course, there I'm introducing the concept of a metric. So another way of saying it, sigma A are the coordinates on sigma itself as a manifold, x mu are the coordinates of a point on our submanifold sigma, but where we're thinking now of coordinate charts of the full manifold. And so dx mu by d sigma a defines a vector in the tangent space of the manifold itself, which is parallel to the surface. Well, so with any manifold, as we know, there's all sorts of different ways that you can coordinatize it. So I'm saying that for this manifold sigma, I could have different ways of coordinatizing my manifold. And so simply it's just saying that for any of those coordinate functions, that this has to be normal. So in other words, it's just, you know, in essence I'm saying, well, if you go, you know, if it was a two-dimensional submanifold, you know, if I go in two independent directions on the submanifold, this n is orthogonal to those two directions. So it's just saying that no matter what you do, there's, you know, n has absolutely no projection onto sigma. It's sort of, I think it's easy to think about it by sort of, you know, just imagining a surface in R cubed and sort of thinking about what it looks like. It's a sort of very helpful way, you know, of having intuition for this. So what we want to do now is think about, there's two things I want to define. The first is obvious. I could, like people do in string theory, think about this thing as just a manifold in its own right and having some independent existence. Or given that I'm thinking of sub-manifolds, I want to see what this sigma inherits from M. And so there are two things that I could think about. First of all, the distance function on sigma. So I can imagine it simply inheriting a metric from M. But then the other thing that's sort of obvious, and these are the two things we'll find, is if you put a sheet in R cubed, although this sheet here and this sheet here, from the point of view of the sheet as being a manifold, are both Ricci flat, but intuitively we think they're different, and they are different as submanifolds. So in that case, we want to have a way of seeing that difference. In other words, we want to talk about how our sheet curves in the manifold. Okay. So the first step is to talk about a metric on sigma. So what we need to do, if we're thinking about it as a submanifold, we're thinking about it in terms of, you know, we're still living in M, but imagining ourselves to be describing sigma. So the first fundamental form is where we take our higher dimensional metric and then kill off everything that is normal to sigma. So what we do is, since these, I've told you that these normal vectors are, I've picked them to be mutually orthogonal and unit, all I have to do is take my components of the metric and subtract off the normal components, and those are encoded in these n vectors. And so this here, this, I have to add relative signs just in case the normal vectors are space-like or time-like. Yep.
Are we summing over I?
Yes. If you like, put it in explicitly. So we need for every extra dimension, we need to subtract off the normal piece. And the reason we're summing over the i's here is because I've specifically said ni and nj are orthogonal if I doesn't equal j. So this is really taking, if this is like a projection onto the tangent space of sigma. So just a few sort of words of caution, or not caution, but just to try and be clear. H lives in the higher dimensional tangent bundle of M, not sigma. In other words, it projects parallel to sigma, which means that we imagine that there's a subspace of TP or TP star, which, actually that's TP, isn't it? Which is spanned by these vectors here. So these are telling you something which is parallel in our intuitive notion of parallel to sigma, and those span a subspace of the tangent space. We could also talk about an intrinsic metric, so I'm leaving a few I's undotted and T's uncrossed here, but hopefully these will be obvious how to fill in the dots. So basically the distinction, I want to draw a distinction between something which lives exclusively on sigma and something which is describing sigma but also lives in the big manifolds, tensor space. So in this case, mu and nu, or A and B, over here, if you can see this, of course. So this is coordinatized by sigma A, where A is 1 to little d, because that's the dimensionality of that manifold of sigma. Then you've got that sigma is described by, say, x mu of sigma A, and mu, of course, runs from 0 to n minus 1. So I've said 1 to d here, but it could be 0 to d minus 1 if it was a space-time, so, you know, if time was one of the coordinates. But the gist is, capital A's run along internal indices, mu's or Roman letters run in the space-time, and I and J here run from 1 to little n, which is, of course, big N minus little d. So I've got quite a few different labels here. I've got my space-time labels, my submanifold labels, and my normal labels. Hopefully it's reasonably clear.
I have a stupid question.
I usually do that.
Oh.
Yeah.
What are the NIAs?
They are the normals. So
NIAs are the normals.
Yes, so they're the components in a particular basis.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's again this, you know, this, I'm not, you know, it's, we're still kind of, there's a little bit of smudging of the boundaries between the abstract index notation and formal notation here, but basically if I put NIA, I'm thinking about the components of N in a particular basis. Although I'm going to switch to this abstract index notation in a little bit. Get my picture straight. So here's schematically what we're doing. So what we're doing here is we're trying to sort of get a set of things which both talk about the submanifold as well as give us information. So this thing here, we can think of this as either sort of spanning the subspace TP of N, or in the way I've used it here is I'm actually projecting some object which lives in TP star of M onto the cotangent space of sigma. Okay, so it sounds like quite a bit of fuss is being made about nothing there, but, yep.
But HAB reduces to gamma AB if we concentrate on the vectors that go on to TP.
It's never a low component by component. That is true.
So if I plug in two vectors that belong to TP sigma, they give the same result.
It's true component by component, but HAB, for example, could be something like this, 1, 0, 0, 1, if we're in three-dimensional Cartesian space and we're projecting down onto the XY plane. HAB is a 3x3 array if I write it down. Gamma, on the other hand, is a 2x2. Yep. So component by component, that is true, but they're different objects, you see.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, if we pick two vectors that belong to sigma, to the tangent space to sigma, and you write them in coordinates that actually belong to sigma, and you fit into that object, and we consider those two vectors, but consider now as vectors of the TPM.
Yes.
Yes,
you get the same answer.
Yes.
Yeah, you do get the same answer, but I'm just trying to draw the distinction that these need not be the same, okay? That here I'm in this discussion, my submanifold is inheriting its structure from the manifold, and so exactly what you say is true, and it's like an intuition. But you should just try and keep in mind that they're separate objects because they're part of different vector spaces. And this becomes more of an issue if you then want to take this smaller manifold and actually make it, in some sense, more fundamental. I'm trying to, in some ways, I've got an agenda in the back of my mind, which is that if you're then coming along and doing the strings course, you're going to sort of see much more of this type of description where the fundamental object is the world sheet. and so the space and doesn't inherit. I mean, it does in the end, but you know, it is defining this bigger space around it. So I'm kind of being a little bit more labouring this point than maybe I otherwise would, simply because you will at some point meet these things in a different context. So that's really why I'm going on about it. And it may seem a bit, you know, a little bit, making a meal of it. But there's a reason. So, so the second fundamental form that we tend to prefer to call it extrinsic curvature form, or it's perhaps more descriptively called extrinsic curvature, tells you how the manifold bends in the submanifold bends in its parent manifold, and it's defined in terms of a covariant derivative of the normal. So here the picture to have in mind is if you've got something like here's a curve which bends in R squared, if I draw my little normals, you can see that as I move around my curve, my normal vector is actually changing. At each point, it's having to just get a little bit of a nudge to the right. So here, when you try and take the covariant derivative of the normal, you will actually pick up something non-zero. And that something non-zero is because this is curving on the plane. And that's what the extrinsic curvature is actually measuring.
So there you're parallel transporting with the connection on the flat space, or on the black hole. So you'd expect that when you move along the curve, you'd expect the arrow to stay pointing like that way. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, so the covariant derivative is sort of telling you, you know, this vector field here, you know, is as what we know it's doing is shifting around. So we can also, if we want, project it down onto the world sheet submanifold. Kind of use the fact that n is normal to sigma to rearrange that. So this is just a different way of seeing this extrinsic curvature, where this covariant derivative here is just, this is just defined by projecting down from the covariant derivative on the parent manifold. So the easiest way to see this is actually by an example of, in fact, one of the simplest examples where people first get confused about curvature and what curvature is. So if we look at the cylinder in R cubed, radius A, when you first get introduced to curvature, it's one of these bizarre things that people expect, say, oh, the cylinder, no, that's curved. And then, you know, you actually have to come to terms with the fact that it isn't, it's Ricci flat. And so now we'll see exactly why people say, no, the cylinder is curved. So that's my normal vector, it's just pointing radially outwards on the plane. So HAB in this case. Is delta AB minus NANB. So if I were to stick to Cartesian coordinates, I'd get that 3x3 matrix. But obviously that kind of, you never really like to have lots of off-diagonal components. Alternatively, if I look at polar coordinates, my metric in polar coordinates is dr squared, so that's a 1, plus r squared d theta squared, so that's an r squared, and then of course plus dz squared. So my n in polars is just 1, 0, 0, and so that's what I end up getting. I've just got the a squared d theta squared piece. That obviously looks a lot better. So in polar coordinates, n is just 1, 0, 0, so all I pick up from this covariant derivative is simply the connection component. So it has so my extrinsic curvature simply has a theta-theta component, and that's equal to A. So what you're seeing here, and we'll see in a bit, that in fact, although the cylinder is Ricci flat, it does have this non-zero extrinsic curvature. So you're seeing that you can pick up what we sort of, I suppose, first meet as curvature, but it's actually the curvature of the embedding in the higher dimensional manifold. So if I chose theta and z as internal coordinates, that's those sigma A's, then I would see that K AB would be A naught naught naught, and gamma AB would be A squared naught naught one. So that's the internal coordinates. And then, just as a, before I actually show how you relate the Ricci curvature to the extrinsic curvatures, I just want to say that if you've got more than, this was codimension one, for greater, if you've got more codimension, you've got two normals, say, for example, codimension two, as you're moving along your object, these normals can kind of move with you, you know, you can get a twisting of the normals. And some of that has some physical meaning and some of it is gauge. And so you've got to, when you're taking covariant derivatives of the normals, you have to realize that there may be some pieces which also are non-zero. So just because the ordering of indices matters here, so. So here I'm using that abstract index notation. So for the mathmos, this is a connection. A connection on the normal bundle of sigma. So our tangent bundle of M has capital N dimensions. We know that the tangent bundle of sigma is going to have little d dimensions. And so for general codimension, that leaves, you know, quite a bit of the tangent bundle of M that hasn't been encoded by sigma. And so that's the normal, I think it's called the normal bundle. And so the name of the game, really, with Gauss-Kodaczy is to try and split up curvature into sort of bits parallel and bits perpendicular to the submanifold. Yep?
Is that I and J on the N, like the I and J component of the vector?
No. So I and J, this labels, this is labeling the normal. So which normal you're on, okay?
Yeah.
So this labels the normal, which normal you are.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably could actually associate it with some coordinatization of the normal space, right? And this is a, you know, this is telling you that it is the, you know, it's in TP star, right, or in T star of N. So this is sort of, as I said, I'm using a bit of abstract index notation here. This is simply saying normal vector, you know, you're taking the free covariant derivative, which is defined in this index here, and you're contracting the covariant derivative of the jth normal with the ith normal. And the ordering of indices is important. So I think you probably just have to sort of just, you know, look at it. So I's and J's there are just labeling the normals in this case, in the way I've written it down there. So I just want to finish with the relation between So if we calculate the Riemann tensor of the submanifold sigma using purely intrinsic quantities, then it turns out that you take the higher dimensional Riemann tensor, project it onto sigma. So that's saying take the parallel components of the Riemann tensor, but that's not quite the whole story. To account that sigma can curve in M, and so that can kind of give you, if you like, a false reading when you do this. So this is telling you how to correctly account for this non-trivial embedding. So remember that you can have flat space, but a non-zero connection, okay, on flat space. And if you're not careful, you can be misled by having non-zero connection components into thinking maybe the space isn't flat. So the simplest example is, of course, polar coordinates. And this is rather analogous. You're saying that if you've got a surface which is twisting in M, that might give you a false reading for your Riemann tensor. So you have to make sure that you're really only looking at the actual curvature itself. So just to finish off today, I'll derive that for you in the simpler case where there's only one extra dimension.
So that three-dimensional curvature still has indices that run from 0 to n minus 1. All right, so you can then pull them back.
Sorry?
That RD still has indices that run from 0 to n minus 1. Would you still have
this is exactly the same sense that HAB, right?
So below 0, but then you can pull them back to something that whose indices only run...
Well, you could, yes, by simply projecting down using the dx by the sigma. Yep. Sort of. So that only works on downstairs indices. Right, so normally we can look at the Riemann tensor by looking at the Riemann identity. I apologise for the double use of the little letter D here. So if little d appears in brackets here, that's just tagging the fact that it's the sigma covariant derivative. So if I replace, remember I said the covariant derivative was just take the manifold derivative and then project everything down. So I'm now going to look at what these indices stand for here. So this would be H. Okay, so what I've got to do in each case is replace, is project at every stage, project my indices down on parallel to sigma. So I use the first fundamental form for that. So I've done that here. This covariant derivative here means that I've got to project the C, D, and A indices, hence the three H's here. And then inside, I've got a covariant derivative V, so that's two indices I've got to project out. Okie doke. So now, let me look at this derivative. It's going to act either on the H's or on the derivative of V. So if I pull these two H's out first, right, wrong index there. Okay, so that's one of the terms, and I'm sorry about that. Taking forever, but anyway. Then I've got to take derivatives of H. But so in order to take derivatives of H, I'm going to use the fact that my H here, HEG, is equal to delta EG plus NEMG. Okay? I can see myself getting to one of these things here where people are going to get really unhappy about me shifting indices around. Okay, so when I'm taking a derivative of the N's, if an N hits an H out here, I get zero, because remember, H is projecting onto sigma, N is normal to sigma. So this NE here, if it hits that H here, it'll be zero. Similarly, if there's another N, actually that's okay, that one. So what I have to do is I've got to take the derivative of that N. So my first term here, I can pull things, contract the indices together. In the second row, well, it's actually plus or minus, I'm not quite sure. Depends on what sort of normal it is. So here, on my second row, I've got plus minus to the I, where that just stands for plus or minus 1, whether n is space-like or time-like. I can pull out one h and act with my derivative on the second h. So that's taking the derivative of HEG, and then I can look at the derivative of HFD. Okay, but now Sorry, I'm trying to decide whether to sort of suspend this, and because it's getting close to Renata's lecture. So I'll sketch, just tell you where the final steps go, and then I think I might get together with Callum to produce a handout of the calculation. You've completely wrecked it for me, Callum. He won't let me do these derivations on the board anymore. So I'm sort of standing here thinking, oh God, I'm going to put everyone off if I carry on with this. So here you can see that you've got your, you know, when you subtract C interchange with D, you're going to get your Riemann identity for the higher dimensional space. So that's going to give you your first piece there. And then for the second piece, here you can see that you've got already some exterior derivative, K. Here you've got just a first derivative of V, but it's contracted with an N. And because V and N are normal, you can swap them at the price of a minus sign. So here you can see this term is going to give you a sort of KCA, because that's where that, you know, where that, that E index goes. And it's going to give you a KFG, so that's then going to be turn into a KD, and then whatever KDB, because you're contracting with V with a minus sign. So that's that first term there, okay? With this line here, you have to, it's a sort of very similar thing, but you have to sort of jiggle around a little bit. So you can sort of see where the different terms are coming from. Actually, I think that second line is zero, and you just get picked from the anti-symmetry of this line. But you kind of have to go through a few steps, and I don't want to run into Renata, so we'll just wrap that up tomorrow, possibly with a handout.
Oh, well, she hasn't done that.
Sorry?
She hasn't derived it. So.
She has?
She hasn't.
She hasn't.
Yeah.
But she uses it. No, I meant she's going to lecture in 5 minutes. And that was what I meant. I've already been going for an hour, so I have to stop. So we'll finish it tomorrow, but possibly by using the handout.